Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. Music of Joaquin Rodrigo, Esta Niña Se Lleva La Flor, sung by our guest today, Laurie Rubin. Laurie Rubin has said that for years she had been listening to and admiring Rodrigo's work, not knowing that they shared something very significant in common. Says she, Rodrigo, like me, was a blind musician. And it was only when in the car on the way to a recent rehearsal that I caught the announcer on the radio mentioning that little bit of trivia. I've always said that I want to be known as an artist in person first, and for my happening to be blind second. And that's why Rodrigo's songs found their way into this recording. Laurie Rubin is very special. We had the pleasure of interviewing her and hearing her wonderful story and just being inspired by her strength of character and her, of course, her ambition and her tremendous talent. Welcome, Laurie Rubin, to WRTI and Crossover.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your story. It's quite a story. And how did you start singing? When did you start singing?
I started singing when I was about 10 and a half. That's when I started taking voice lessons. And it sort of snowballed from there. Once I started taking voice lessons, the Jewish community in LA sort of got wind of the fact that I was taking lessons because my parents were very involved in organizations like the UJF and United Jewish Fund and Anti-Defamation League and Hadassah. Mm-hmm. And so they had this little 10-year-old girl singing national anthems at their various events. And a lot of these incorporated people like George Burns and Alan King and Walter Matthau and late Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. So that was really where I got my start singing in public. In the meantime, I was also very kind of good friends with Kenny Loggins, which was a very interesting. He was sort of like my unofficial teacher of music 101, because when I was around 4 years old, we met him and we went to one of his concerts, and it sort of snowballed from there and became groupies. And I learned a lot about music and about harmony and just from seeing his concerts and watching him in the studio. And eventually got to sing on his album. But in terms of doing classical, I always loved classical because when I was really, really young, it was like maybe 3 or 4, I started taking piano lessons. And my parents used to play classical music on their stereo. My grandparents played classical music all the time because they're from Austria. And so they loved playing Strauss. They loved Carmen. They loved all kinds of opera. And so I just had an affinity for it. And then when I saw Phantom of the Opera when I was about 11 years old, I just fell in love with that style. And I said, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to be the role of Christine. And my teacher, who is a Juilliard alum, asked me after I did the song Think of Me from Phantom. She asked me to do classical. And so that's how it snowballed from there. That's how I got my start.
Well, tell us a little bit for the audience. You had retinal dysfunction. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was born with essentially, very, very little retina. So what that means is that I can only see light, which is helpful, but they still see that as no usable vision. So I'm essentially totally blind.
Now, when you said you were playing piano, how did you learn that? I mean, did you have piano lessons? I mean, you said you sat down and you kind of played the piano.
Right. Well, I had lessons and I discovered shortly after that that I had perfect pitch, which to me, and I'm realizing now how not abnormal that is. There's quite a few people who have perfect pitch.
It's annoying also sometimes.
Yeah, it can be. Do you have it as well?
I don't, but I know that when you have perfect pitch and you hear a lot of people out of tune, it's very, very irritating.
I'm sure. Especially when you're the one that is out of tune.
Well, not necessarily.
No, but like, but anyway, so it's just like, it's been just a wonderful experience, I think, in general, you know, doing classical music. And I think it really, when I was in high school, being able to do classical sort of got me to have a group of friends that were like me. Because when I went to a private school, I was the only blind student, and I was very different than the other kids in their opinion. They just didn't know me, and they were afraid to get to know me. But when I would go to do choirs, and when I would do programs like Tanglewood or other things like that, that's where we were all, even though we were all different, we came from different backgrounds. Some of us were from different parts of the world, but what brought us together was the fact that we loved music. And so blindness was such a minor part of me to them, so they didn't treat me differently.
We've just heard music of Gabriel Fauré, Les Berceuses, soprano Laurie Rubin performing with Maria Stroke at the piano. Well, the thing in terms of reading music, mm-hmm. How did that work?
In terms of reading music, I actually never learned properly how to read Braille music, and I really should have. But by the time I got to Braille music, it was very late. And I must have been about 17 or 18. And of course, by that time, your brain is developed in a certain way. And I had been so used to learning music by ear and had developed the filters for that and had learned regular music theory and so knew about the staff. So when I saw Braille music, it didn't look anything to me like what had been described to me. And so it never was as intuitive to me, and it never came as naturally. So I still do things by ear. And when I do new music, and I did quite a bit of new music when I lived in New York, I had composers send me their MIDI recordings because they automatically input in things into MIDI, into Sibelius. So that's how I learned their music when there were no recordings out there to listen to.
You wanted contemporary music because it was more, you didn't have enough with the regular, you know, tonal music. You decided you were going to defy the other odds as well. I agree with you. It's just impossible. But I think it's certainly a way of thinking and a way of listening. Mm. And music is music. And I just have to say that you really are amazing in your accomplishments. You have a beautiful, beautiful voice. You've sung opera as well, isn't that right?
Definitely. Yeah, I've sung in some operas.
Tell us a little about your experiences in terms of you defied all the odds. You said to everybody, you know, this is who I am. This is what I do. You ski. Is that right?
That's right, actually. Yeah. And I mean, it started with having parents who set the precedent for that. They really wanted me to do everything they did. So they found ski schools for the blind when they would go skiing. And I worked with instructors for a while, private instructors on form and other skiing techniques. And then as I got older, I just had a ski guide that I would go with, and I would be skiing with my parents, and the guide would just be there to call turns. And I was just by myself on that mountain with, you know, somebody a few feet behind me calling left, right, left, right.
My Lord. I just think that's amazing because I think even sighted people wouldn't even attempt that. Now, cooking, designing jewelry, that's something I was fascinated with.
Oh, thank you. Well,
I love jewelry.
I do, too. I do, too. And that's what made me really want to do that was because, well, I was living in New York for about a year and a half, and I was getting some gigs, but it wasn't regular pay, and I wanted to do something in addition to singing. And, of course, temping and things were sort of out of the question because, you know, in terms of adaptive technology, once you put that into an office, it's kind of one of those things that's hard to remove and get it in conjunction with another computer system. So a lot of job opportunities were a little bit limited to me. So I decided to start learning making jewelry because a friend of my mother's had designed some bracelets and had started taking classes. And when I saw her, she came and visited, I noticed her bracelet. And she said, you know, Laura, you could totally design jewelry because it's done really by touch. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited because I love jewelry. And my wallet has always been a little bit lighter after being at a jewelry store. So I was happy that I could make my own. And I started, I got a teacher from the Jewish Community Center in New York and to teach me privately. And after about 6 months, I started making my own stuff on my own. And I sold it at various private jewelry showings at people's houses that I knew. Some of it was sold in boutiques in New York and in LA and various places. So that was a side business that I always kept up even while I was doing my music.
Well, of course, that has a great deal to do with the feel of what you're doing, I suppose. Mm. And I love your earrings.
Oh, thank you.
They're beautiful. Did you design those?
I did, yeah.
Oh, they're gorgeous. They're long and they're gold and they have, what kind of a stone is that on them?
It's some kind of a quartz.
It's a quartz. Very beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Very beautiful. Well, you have defied the odds, obviously. And this album, Do You Dream in Color, you said that was inspired by a child's question.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that story. It's very moving.
Oh, thank you. Well, I often go to concerts, and a lot of times the people who are the most forward with their questions, which is lovely, are kids. And many kids ask me if I dream in color, which I find interesting. And this one little girl, it's kind of a combination of several. I've asked them to describe color to me because I said, well, I don't know if I dream in color. Why don't you tell me what color is? Because I want to get their sense of it. And they start listing things and getting very excited and interactive. And one of the things that I found so unique is when one kid said they couldn't think of, they were sort of stumped when it came to yellow. And then they said, oh, wait, yellow, it's the color of my hair. And they figured, well, you know me, so you know my hair, and therefore you know what yellow is, you know. And it actually, you know, was quite sort of enlightening because I started thinking about yellow as being like youth, you know, and somebody who's willing to ask questions. And yellow is sort of close to green, which is also very indicative of young, like a
fresh,
young bud.
Fresh
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that was so,
because
inspiring.
To define color is very, very hard.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So now the song that's on here. Mm-hmm. By Bruce Adolph. You wrote the poem.
Right.
Is that right? And yeah. What is the poem? Can you give us a little of quote from there?
Well, first of all, Bruce, the composer, he had asked me to, he wanted to write a song cycle for me. And he had first asked me what kind of poetry is moving to me. And then I, you know, sent him all this poetry that I loved. And then what he really wanted was me to write a poem about being blind, which I hemmed and hawed about for the longest time because I didn't want it to be hokey. But then I realized this was my opportunity to share with the world what I don't usually get to tell people in the 30-second pitch or in an audition or, you know, and I know that, of course, there's these white elephants in the room whenever I'm around these people. And so they need to hear it. They need to know what my life is like and right. How actually it's not that different. So I think that my favorite part of the poem is after, so the whole poem is about, is various different people asking me if I dream in color and me answering it. But the last person who asks says, do you have realistic dreams? And it's really that person is a metaphor for all the people I've dealt with who have hesitated to hire me because they don't believe that my life could possibly be translated onto the stage because being blind means you're too isolated to do anything. And so I end the poem by saying, may I ask you a question? Do you dream in color? And it sort of makes them realize that dreaming in color, that they maybe haven't taken the time to dream or think outside the box, whereas my whole life has been about me figuring out how to live up to my dreams. And so it's to inspire them and to sort of shake them into being creative and to think about their dreams. And that's what really inspired me to write the whole poem was the punchline.
Do you dream?
Portion of Do You Dream in Color, a work written by Bruce Adolf with Laurie Rubin, mezzo-soprano, and Maria Stroke, pianist, performing. The music by Mr. Adolf is, of course, accompanying the poem that was written by Laurie Rubin, which was quite a long and probing one. She says, "The question he asks me is, do you have realistic dreams? I answer, I hate to answer your question with another question. Shouldn't you be asking me if I dream in color? I sense his unease. It was hard for him to do what he felt he must do, to tell the girl who was more than admirable for getting out of bed in the morning, endearing to have dreams of singing on stage, to tell this girl that she must be realistic, dream in color. He is confused. Yes, I say. I dream of the red gown that I'll wear on stage, that is striking against my fair skin and dark brown hair. I dream of my lover's black hair. I dream in all the colors of the rainbow. You didn't ask me if I dream in color because you don't believe I can. You imagine my world a dark place. You are afraid to know that I walk the streets of New York with purpose, that I come home to a family I've cultivated, that my life is full of dreams, and my dreams are full of colors, and my dreams are real because they come true every day." He says, "I see." I ask, "May I ask you a question? Do you dream in color?" It's a very, very moving, isn't the word? It demands an answer, if you
exactly.
know what I mean. yeah, and what is color, I guess, right? I mean,
right.
I think dreams a lot of times are not in color.
Right.
And that doesn't matter whether you're sighted or not.
Mm.
But the other side of the story here is that you have a beautiful classical voice.
Oh, thank you.
And you have sung opera.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about that experience.
About singing opera? Oh,
yeah.
I love it. I always tell people that opera is like skiing. It's like an athletic activity because when you're singing melismatic passages and going up and down and doing coloratura, you're flying, you're going all over the place, you're using your air. It's just a wonderful feeling of movement that even as you're standing still. And being on stage is really an amazing experience because I've done lots of chamber music and art song, but when you're spending a couple of hours with a character on stage,
yes.
you become that person and you live with them as you study that person. You kind of intuit all the parts of their story, their backstory that you don't know. And then being on stage and being sort of spontaneous and in the moment it's really, really helpful to artistry and specificity and stuff. So I really enjoy that. I love when directors take the plunge and let me move around by myself.
I was just going to ask you about that. What is that like?
It's fantastic because I walk around by myself when I'm in fact, you know, Jenny and I just got to our hotel last night and, you know, most hotel rooms are laid out the same and just walked in the room and I walked around the hotel all by myself, all over the room and, you know, putting stuff where I wanted it. And that's essentially how I do a stage. And my own kitchen when I'm cooking and you know, you just learn to navigate the dangerous parts and not to, you know, tread too near the orchestra pit on stage.
Yeah. Well, I know people that have fallen off the pit and they
can
know
see.
Where they're going.
So. Yeah, exactly. It happens. And I've even heard about the story about the woman who jumped to her death in an opera scene and opera, and they put a trampoline underneath there.
Oh my God.
So there have been some pretty funny stories, but you know, I think for me, the biggest thing is just knowing where all the set pieces are, knowing where, for example, if I'm in a church doing an opera scene, knowing where the organ is, because that's, I can use a lineup for that to get to the stage part. If I'm on like a stage in a hall, knowing where the revolving set pieces are or where the beds are, where the, I did a version of La Voix Humaine, the human voice, which is the only props are a telephone.
Yeah.
And
well,
it was amazing.
Congratulations.
Oh, and you know what? I love that challenge because singing up there by yourself intuiting not only your own character, but somebody else on the other end of a telephone line was really kind of a neat. And the way I did that one was actually I used my light perception because the director had three dancers. And he discovered very shortly after we were working together that I was using the lights to get from point A to point B. And so he started using that more and more. And, so he, and if there wasn't a physical landmark, because all we had was a phone and a chair, he would say, OK, Lori, follow the light, follow the middle light. And so ironically, in that situation, I was probably using my sight more than most sighted people. They wouldn't even think to look for the light. They would just, you know, walk, make a beeline toward whatever set piece they wanted.
Is it a bright light that you see? Or?
Yeah, it was. Well, those particular lights were sort of, they were like spotlights. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and it was completely, almost pitch black. There was just a little bit of lighting on stage other than the three lights. So for me, there was so much contrast. It was almost like looking at a flashlight. And, you know, and in fact, when there's a blackout and there's flashlights on, I can see the flashlights. And I always joke with people that I guess I'm at an advantage when there's a power failure.
That's right. Well, you know, I had been told just recently that we don't use our eyes shut enough because people count on that. And you really to find your way. I mean, you know, just by feeling or the sense of distance, you really don't use that. You know, the brain, you just don't accommodate that with the brain when you do, when you can see where you're going.
Right.
And it's a very, very important thing. It's a sense of where you are in
absolutely
terms of space.
Absolutely. And my feeling is that if people close their eyes for a long enough time, and I think this does happen, you start to realize your other four senses really do work in harmony.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, certainly I think playing an instrument is like that a lot.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
You know, I mean, that's really all feel. So now what are some of the roles that you have sung actually operatically?
I've sung Cenerentola, Cinderella.
Yes.
And I sang the role of Penelope in The Return of Ulysses by Monteverdi, which was, that was amazing. I mean, that music with all those dissonances and those suspensions, I just love it. I could do Baroque music every day. I would love it. And then I did La Voix Humaine, which was probably in a way the most rewarding and challenging role because actually if you lived with me, which my poor partner had to live with me for that, like for, you know, those months before, I was a mess because it's all about abandonment and all these things we fear, being, you know, all left alone in this place and having somebody leave you for someone else. And so I was a very difficult person to live with because I was always weeping. But that's just how you become your role, I think.
That's not Poulenc.
Yeah, it's Poulenc. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And it's also in real time, which makes it even more, it's not
difficult.
Like, it doesn't take place over several weeks or several months. It's like, you know, all in 45 minutes. So those are the main, you know, three roles I've played. I also played the lead in Gordon Biefermann's opera, The Ratland, and he's a composer that is living, unlike some of these others. And this opera includes microtones and all kinds of other new music extended techniques. And we did this with New York City Opera. And that was really cool. And I always joked with Gordon. I said, you know, you're going to make me do these microtones. People are going to think that I'm sharp or flat, you know, because it's
that's
in between.
Impossible.
I know.
It's very difficult, like Indian music in a way, you know, kind of the ragas and so on.
That's true.
Yeah, really. So actually, your classical training was where? Music?
I started in L.A. when I was very young and through high school. And then I went to Oberlin. Uh-huh. I studied with Richard Miller, who has since passed, but he was really one of the greats in terms of vocal teachers. And then I studied at Yale. I went to Yale Opera.
Wonderful.
And then just studied with a wonderful teacher in New York named Valerie Sorel, who I adore. I mean, she was just fantastic. And she took me to that next level, which was what I needed.
Which level is that?
Well, you know, one of the things that is so, that was frustrating to me as I was in college was that I couldn't get piano. I just couldn't find a way to change the color of my voice when I wanted to. I mean, I knew how I was feeling, but I just couldn't assimilate
get
that
it.
Somehow. Yeah. And what I realized was when I worked with this teacher, and it's probably stuff that teachers have been trying to tell me for years, but it just has to be the right time and the right way somebody mentions it. But she was so very into resonance and spatial awareness with your own body and breathing, but especially the resonance. And she would have me do this interesting exercise that was sort of like the Tuvan throat singers, where you go ear, and you're listening very hard for these overtones. And when you can find that, I always call it the eye of the sound, like that point of the sound. It's so much easier to go build from that, go from a tiny pianissimo to a forte. So I really, really credit my being able to do pianissimos to her.
Pianissimo is harder to say it than do it. Music of Joaquin Rodrigo, based on a poem by a composer of the 15th century. We heard, Muy graciosa es la doncella. So graceful is the maiden. Performed by Laurie Rubin, soprano, with Maria Stroke, pianist. But you do gravitate to contemporary music, is that right? Is there a reason for that?
I think the reason that happened was, it was really interesting, because when I was in college, I was so afraid to touch new music because all my teachers were saying, don't do it, it's bad for your voice, you have to do straight tone.
Why is it bad for your voice?
Well, because I think their perception is, and I think it's kind of a misconception, is that you'd have to start doing things with your voice, like singing in your throat or screaming or doing things that are bad. But what I found was that when I did straight tone, which came naturally to me even as a younger person, that it was, if you do it right, you're actually using your technique to the best of its capacity because you're breathing right, you're using your center properly.
When you say a straight tone, that's without vibrato.
Yeah, and that's actually found a lot in Baroque music. Yeah.
Yes.
I loved when I graduated from Yale. One of the first gigs I got was at Carnegie Hall. It was a workshop with John Harbison and Don Upshaw, and they matched the singer with the composer. And I was matched with somebody who had me do all kinds of funky stuff. And I had Don Upshaw to tell me, no, you don't have to scream. Just sing with angst. Or when you inhale while singing, just take a normal deep breath and just try to phonate at the same time. So I had really good coaches. And I think what I realized was that being blind and being one of those people that opera directors were a little afraid to hire, it was so good that I could do something like new music because other singers often
don't
want to do it. So it was like a niche for me. And having that niche was really, 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 really important in getting me to be heard by other people. And that's how Wuhan from the Chamber Music Society heard me and had me sing in one of her concerts. And that's how Bruce Adolph met me to do the Do You Dream in Color poem.
So you have a special, you know, I guess, niche in a way, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I love doing it. I mean, I would just, you know, and this Saturday, you know, we're giving a concert or I do concerts once in a while that are all classical. In fact, one of the concerts I'm doing is going to be all German music. So I'm like, yay, I get to sing romantic stuff again.
Now, when you study that, of course, it's all part of the voice study, isn't it, to learn the language?
Absolutely. Yeah. And when I was at both Oberlin and Yale, I had to learn German, Italian, and French. And when I was at Yale, I had to learn, not only did I have to learn Russian diction, but I had to learn how to read Cyrillic in Braille.
That's punishment, I think.
It was great.
How do you do that in Braille? That's amazing. Well, I guess they have a way of doing it.
Absolutely.
Because the characters are not Arabic.
That's right. Well, what they did was, and this is how it's worked for Hebrew, too. There's only so many combinations of six dots. So they use certain combinations. They recycle them. So, for example, in Hebrew, the ah sound is actually what you might see in literary Braille, in English Braille as a colon. So I just, when I was reading Hebrew, I just knew that it was an ah sound. And the same thing in Russian. I just started to get the sense that the ly sound was this certain character in Braille.
That's so interesting. Well, yeah. The whole thing of, I mean, what you've done is really amazing. Would you say that you have, of course, you have, not would you say, you have developed a sixth and seventh sense, I think, because you don't rely on seeing, but you do see some light, you said. And of course, as far as hearing is concerned, you know exactly where you what you want to hear. Isn't that right? I mean, you're...
Yeah. Sixth or seventh sense. Well, I think that I'm definitely... Well, I was joking with my manager the other day because I had this dream about her going to Russia or something, and several other things about the dream were very specific. And then she called me immediately. She said, "I can't even tell you how much your dream just emulated everything that happened in a conversation I just had." And
well, about, you had ESP, probably.
Yeah, about going to Russia and like you know and meeting making opportunities for artists there. And I was like, "That's so weird." But I think that was just a coincidence. But I would say the sixth sense that I have comes from more listening to people's inflection. I remember there was one time that I went with my mother, my parents, we were having lunch and somebody came over to the table and he was smiling, but I could tell in his voice that he had just been crying. And I said, "What's wrong, Steve?" It was just, you know, it was a friend of theirs. And then he proceeded to tell my parents about some business thing that had just happened that was, he was afraid it was going to ruin his business. And my mom looked at me and she said, "How did you know that there was something wrong?" I was like, "Well, you could tell he was just like crying." And she's like, "And you know, I guess the smile fools people, you know." And so for
the
me,
it's the voice.
Yeah. It gives everything away. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't say it's a sixth sense as much as that, the fact that I don't have sight. So I'm listening more. And especially since I know that I can't see body language, I really try to know what's going on based on what people are doing in their emotions.
Well, you're sensitive. I mean, you care and you listen. People that are sighted very often don't care and they don't listen to the other person. But I guess sometimes there, I do believe though in an ESP or a sixth sense because I get these vibrations and then it happens.
Yeah, so, you know, like that dream.
It's very, very weird.
I think it does. Yeah, it's very strange.
So in any case, you have this great album and you also have Defy the Odds and you have some great supporters from what I've read in your publicity material. You worked with the great Joan Sutherland.
Yes.
Oh, that was amazing.
She was, yeah.
And what was her reaction to you and how did that happen?
I was scared when I first sang for her because when we all first sang for her, it was at a masterclass in England. She immediately turned to me and not to me, to all of us and said, "You have no musicality. You're just singing notes and all this horrible." Like, I just thought, oh no, I've ruined it for the whole week. But then when I sang Cenerentola the next day, she was amazingly complimentary and said how much feeling I had. And so maybe she just wanted us all to be scared into singing well or something.
Well, I would if I had to sing for her, I'm sure.
Yeah,
she's an amazing.
Absolutely. But she was amazing. But I think what was so remarkable about her was, and you get this feeling from all these opera singers, is that they're just human beings and they just happen to have a great career. And so there was one time somebody sat down in a chair and it was squeaking. And she goes, "Sounds like somebody's got a poo-poo chair," you know, and she meant like a whoopee cushion, you know, that
yes,
you sit on.
Of course, yeah.
And she was just funny that way. But then she would really mostly defer to her husband, Richard Bonning.
Yes, he knew everything and ran her life.
Yeah,
I guess,
I think
in a sense. He knew exactly.
He knew
what
her better
wanted,
than she knew.
Of Gabriel Fauré, we just heard Nell, performed by Laurie Rubin, mezzo-soprano, with Maria Stroke, pianist. Mm-hmm. So tell me, what is on the agenda for you? You did release this album, and then what's next? Are you performing live in any, you know, opera performances?
Well, I will be performing in Switzerland. Well, yeah, just all this East Coast stuff is pretty much almost over because we just had a big tour here. But we'll be going to Switzerland next month because we're doing Do You Dream in Color in its orchestral version, which will be sort of the world premiere of the slightly truncated version of it with for the International Human Rights Conference.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. And it will be done with an orchestra made up of people from all over the world. And then we will be doing that again in October with another big orchestra. As soon as the ink is dry on the contract, I can let you know it is. But I'll tell you it's an orchestra in the Los Angeles area.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, so we're excited about that. And then I'll be doing an opera, a Britain opera in New York City, Noya's Flood.
Oh, yes.
I'll be playing Mrs. Noya.
Oh, my.
And we'll be doing that as it's actually the 100th anniversary of the International Lighthouse for the Blind. But I think, as far as I know, I'm the only blind person in the opera right now. So we're very
excited.
What
do you think of Andrea Bocelli, his voice and what he's done with it?
I love his voice. I have to say, I love that he, in his lower register, that he sounds like Sting, and that in his upper register, he sounds like Pavarotti. I think that is really cool because one of the things that Jenny and I are working on now is a pop album, which is so different than both of our direction has always been classical, but we've secretly, of course, loved pop for, well, not so secretly.
That's good. You're allowed.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad I got the permission from a classical person.
Well, I love it too, so.
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't say that Andrea Bocelli is an opera singer, but I admire what he does and, you know, would love to see him get a little bit more edgy with his material, a little bit more modern.
Well,
and stuff.
Think he's told what to sing, and I'm so sorry about that. But he certainly has caused a sensation,
absolutely,
for singers. So, in other words, then you this whole tour that you're going on is to promote the album. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, promote actually also even my memoir, which is also called Do You Dream in Color?
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that.
Right. And that also definitely takes you on a journey through my life as a blind artist, blind opera singer, and just even a normal person who goes through all those crappy stuff, things in middle school, you know, like you treated, you're bullied, you're, you know, all that stuff. So it's really, to me, what I wanted to get across was not only this voyeuristic look into a blind person's life to sort of make people's curiosities melt away, but also what I wanted to do was share a universal story, because we all deal with challenges and we all have an Achilles heel that, you know, people either know about us or don't know about us. And I just wanted to always encourage people to really share their universal stories and to feel good about the things that that make them unique.
We're speaking with Laurie Rubin, mezzo-soprano, about her newest release, Do You Dream in Color? One of the highlights of the albums is a song cycle for voice and piano composed by Noam Sivan and with poetry of Leah Goldberg. It's a song cycle for voice and piano and is unique in its intimacy within contemporary Hebrew literature. The four poems belong to the cycle and illustrate a very strong yearning for love, whether love of life, love of nature, or romantic love, we cannot tell. This love, however, is facing insurmountable obstacles within cliffs, among stones, and looking straight through eternity. A little bird symbolizes this love in some of the poems, while stones occur repeatedly, symbolizing an indifferent surrounding world. When turned into music, the dramatic message of the poems is heightened, depicting emotions ranging from happiness to anxiety and despair. The last song is the most lyrical in the cycle, resolving the previous tension and leaving room for hope. In the Mountains of Jerusalem, a song cycle for voice and piano composed by Noam Sivan with poetry by Leah Goldberg. Thank you. We've just heard the final song in the cycle for voice and piano, In the Mountains of Jerusalem, composed by Noam Sivan, with poetry by Leah Goldberg, performed by Laurie Rubin, mezzo-soprano, with Noam Sivan at the piano. Well, you are certainly unique, and you also are terribly talented, oh, because that's kind of lucky in a way. I mean, that you have a gorgeous voice,
oh,
and
you
are musical. But also, you can teach us a lesson in terms of, you know, doing what your talents give you, and following through, even if you have perhaps no physical disabilities. A lot of people give up, you know, and someone who has, you know, you believe in yourself and you've overcome certain things that other people could not, but you also have a talent, which is something that is really quite amazing.
Oh,
I mean,
thank you.
You know, that's a God-given thing. And what is the response to you when you've gone on the book tour? Where is that? Is it available to us?
Absolutely. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, iTunes, I'm sorry, iBooks, and any ebook reader. I know a lot of people like the Kindle and the Nook, and you can get it on any of those. The response has been really, really amazing. I was worried, especially I'm a first-time author. I've always loved to write, but I just didn't know if I was conveying enough, if I was showing enough, what ended up happening is I got all these emails to my websites from people I didn't even know. And they all shared with me their very personal story about challenges and said, you know, I just want to let you know that I feel from your story that we relate. And even if it's about, whether it's about blindness or not, I just feel like we're just people. And thank you for sharing that, you know. And then there have been other people who've said, thank you for being so informative about things I've never thought about with blindness before. So those are all the kinds of things that I wanted to get across with the book. It was certainly my way of getting people into my living room in a way and just getting them to feel more comfortable, because a lot of times people aren't comfortable with a blind person when they first see them. They don't feel like they'd be approachable. And I wanted them to know that, you know, pretty much I'm an open book, quite literally.
I think, you know, a lot of it is that people don't speak. I mean, they just do things physically.
Body language,
body language. So the point is they don't communicate.
That's right.
And I think that's one of the things. You don't realize how little you communicate.
That's right.
You know, it's all, you know, it's physical and not verbal.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the things. But again, I think people have to be educated to know how to act and to experience, you know, I guess, other avenues of I guess, making it through life. You know, it's life is tough no matter what. And
absolutely.
I think you're really inspiring and
thank
also
you.
Quite remarkable and quite talented. And that helps. I think talent does help.
But
you have built a career really with a real voice, with real music. And of course, you've even tackled the contemporary. But once again, Laurie, thanks so much for giving us your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Really. And we look forward to the next project.
Thank you.
For a second listen to selected Crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Patti, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.